Club. It's an annual talk fest for Russian academics, diplomats, and politicians. Vladimir Putin typically attends. Desai is interested in this kind of stuff. She's a political scientist at the University of Manitoba, specializing in U.S. hegemony, globalization, and contemporary imperialism from a critical Marxist perspective. Among Desai's positions, that the U.S. and NATO provoked Russia into invading Ukraine, and that the war, now into its 18th bloody month, is actually an American proxy war on Russia, so definitely beyond mainstream. As it happens, here in Canada, the Valdai Discussion Club is beyond the pale. Last September, Ottawa slapped sanctions on it for, quote, generating and disseminating disinformation and propaganda, unquote. As if this didn't put Desai in a delicate spot, she got to ask Vladimir Putin a question. What did Russia's president think about that standing ovation 98-year-old Yaroslav Hunka got in the Canadian Parliament for fighting the Russians in World War II on the side of the Nazis? Putin's answer, nuanced and diplomatic, sent ripples across global media and a tsunami in its wake. Desai's question, her mere presence at the forum, was, quote, morally reprehensible and pretty horrendous, one Canadian right-winger declared. Hate mail now flows into Desai's inbox, but her students support her. I reached Radhika Desai at her home in Winnipeg. Tell me about your encounter with Vladimir Putin. You got to ask Vladimir Putin a question at the Valdai discussion group in Sochi, and you weren't expecting him to take your question, and he did. Tell me about that encounter.
Well, I had submitted a question because lately in the Valdai Club, we submit questions ahead of time. And, you know, last year I had submitted a question and I didn't get asked. So I had no guarantee that I would be asked a question, but I had or I would be given the chance to ask my questions, but I had submitted it. And this time around, I was recognized. So I got to ask my question. And of course, I piggybacked my question with a personal appeal to him. About Boris Kagarlitsky, somebody many listeners may know about. He's a very fine Russian intellectual, a personal friend of mine and my husband, Alan Freeman's. And we are all concerned about the fact that he's being detained on some charges of abetting terrorism, which sound quite incredible to us. But so I just wanted to essentially ensure that the president himself would take an interest in the matter, because I'm sure if he did, then he would realize that there's absolutely no need to treat Boris quite as harshly as I think he is being treated. I mean, I'm not in direct communication with Boris, but I'm in communication with those who are. So I asked my question in English. He presumably heard it in Russian, although I suspect he probably understands English quite well. He answered in Russian. And of course, I asked about the Canadian Parliament issue, you know, what happened with the applause of the celebration of the Mr. Hunka, who was known to be a Nazi. A collaborator and a Nazi himself, being applauded in Parliament. This was, of course, a very it affronted Jewish opinion in Canada, Polish opinion, as we know. There were, you know, these people were directly involved in the killing of all these people. But it also, of course, affronts Russia. So I wanted to take the opportunity to ask the president of the country that has contributed, arguably, according to most credible historians, made the critical contribution to the winning of the Second World War against Nazism. I mean, how do you feel that one of your allies of that time is now doing this? And he gave his answer.
And he answered your question.
Mm-hmm. He answered, he said that he didn't know it was going to come, but he had prepared for it because he thought somebody might ask such a question. So he rattled off some interesting facts, one of which was that actually, you know, contrary to the Canadian government essentially sort of just saying, you know, the speaker did something wrong and he has resigned, so everything is fine. The fact of the matter is that there are many other people in Parliament who should have known better. But anyway, Mr. Putin pointed out that In the Nuremberg trials itself, if you read the records of the Nuremberg trial, this organization had been labeled as a Nazi organization, as a criminal organization. And so in that sense, you know, and then he rattled off the figures of how many Jews they had killed, how many Polish people they had killed. And also he said Roma, uncounted numbers of Roma were killed. But he said, you know, in those days, people didn't even care enough to count how many Roma were killed.
Now, I think, you know, jumping to Canadian public opinion and the CBC, there was a report in CBC about this, about the fact that a University of Manitoba professor had, a political sciences professor had attended a session with Vladimir Putin present, and she asked Putin a question and talked about what had happened on the floor of the Canadian House of Commons, and there was a little bit of blowback for you. I mean, I think the point is that people are shocked, some people are shocked, that a University of Manitoba professor would be at some intellectual club or gathering in Sochi, Russia, and have the chance to ask Vladimir Putin a question, which didn't really present Canada in a very, I don't know, very favorable light, and it gave Putin the chance to get in some chops against. But well, maybe. I mean, he said he doesn't have anything, he doesn't want to criticize Canada. Getting to the point, people are shocked that, some people are shocked that a Canadian academic would be there present and asking Putin a question and be actually sympathetic to the Russian position vis-a-vis its war in Ukraine.
Right. So there are a whole bunch of points you are making here. So first of all, let me say that about the Canadian media, about the CBC, etc., if they had done their job properly and had reported on the fact that we had already gone quite a long way down in terms of celebrating these Nazi figures in Canada rather than holding them to account in any way, we would have actually, Parliament wouldn't have been where it was. You know, the fact of the matter is that what happened in Parliament was not a mistake, which is what the dominant discourse here is trying to make it out to be. And the opposition, like the Conservatives, also have an interest in saying, oh, it was just a mistake, because so long as it's just as Speaker Rota's mistake, then they are off the hook. They also stood up and clapped. Well, they shouldn't have. And they should have known better. All of these people are supposed to be highly educated people. How come they didn't know? If they were told right there and then that this man had been fighting the Russians in World War II, did even one or two of them, not out of 400 plus people, did not even one or two people say, hang on a minute, if he was fighting against the Russians, who was he fighting with? Who could it have been? It was the Nazis. So there is there is that whole point that essentially the media has, you know, the media is reporting on the fact that some people are upset about me. Fine. If they had done their job, I wouldn't have had to do any of this. I would rather not paint Canada in a good light. But given that this had happened, I feel that this is my duty as a Canadian, because I care about Canada, because I care about Canada not taking the wrong positions. And also, by the way, this also connects with my position on the war, because I care about Canada and I care about Ukraine. It's important for me to point up exactly where we are going wrong, because if nobody speaks, then we are not going to know that this emperor of Canada's war with Russia has no clothes. OK, so we have to speak. And therefore, I spoke. There's another element involved here. You pointed out that a blowback. You said I got a lot of blowback. Actually, yes, there were lots of people who criticized me, some of them in quite a vile fashion. But I'm amused to note, by the way, that at least some of these people were actually people who are like this guy, Marcus Kolga and Bill Browder. I mean, these are professional anti-Russians. I mean, they have made their whole life out of being anti-Russian. So if they criticize me, I have nothing to say. I mean, what else are they going to do? I mean, that's their occupation, it seems to me. What's really interesting to me is the number of people, including students I taught decades ago, who wrote to me and said, great, I'm so glad you did this. I suddenly feel better. I feel so awful about what happened in Parliament and we're not making enough out of it. And you were very good to have asked this question. So I have had equal measure of both, I would say. And considering that a lot of my friends who know me are not going to write me special emails, they'll just tell me when they see me. Actually, I would say that there is a lot of concern within Canada that we should have got here. There is far less support for Canada's position vis-a-vis Russia than you might imagine, and a great deal of discomfort with what our parliament ended up doing.
And you've said that anti-Russian propaganda is wall-to-wall in countries like Canada.
Wouldn't you agree?
You've also said, I'm paraphrasing you here, that the Ukraine war, the Russia-Ukraine war, it's really a U.S.-NATO war. It's a U.S. war against NATO to absorb NATO into the U.S. economy.
No, I didn't say NATO into the U.S. economy, but that may be a misquote, but I can address that if you like. So first of all, and this is not news. I mean, I have had this position since the war began, since the conflict over Ukraine broke out into military action in February 2022. And I have been writing in various places about this. And it is also a part of my book, Capitalism, Coronavirus and War, A Geopolitical Economy. There's a whole chapter in the book, plus, of course, it pervades the analysis. So what's my position? My position is that if there is one word that is used repeatedly in what I call the wall-to-wall propaganda in the Western media, and I would say if you just have to open the pages of The Guardian or the CBC or the Globe and Mail or the practically any media, mainstream media outlet in Western countries, that's all you will see. Is, you know, Putin is responsible for this war. So if there is a single word that is completely wrong, I mean, it's like they are using this word precisely because they want to make untruth truth. And that word is unprovoked. Everybody keeps saying Russia's unprovoked aggression against Ukraine. Folks, there is absolutely nothing unprovoked about this. The West has been rattling Russia's cage more or less since the end of communism. The West subjected Russia to shock therapy for a whole decade, in whose horrors are yet to be, you know, most people don't realize that Russia went from being a very sophisticated, high technology economy that was created under the Soviet Union. It took a precipitous dive to the point where, you know, productive enterprises were shut down, unemployment was massive, poverty, hunger, deprivation pervaded even formerly well-to-do middle-class people. I mean, Russia was really at a low, low point. Longevity declined. People were living less long. And so this was the opening. Then the other important thing was that at the time when Gorbachev agreed to the unification of Germany, which meant that a previously Warsaw Pact country now became part of NATO, he was assured, and now we have documentary evidence, despite denials, which completely make rubbish of the denials of the West. He was assured explicitly that NATO would not expand eastward one inch. But already by the late 1990s, NATO began expanding eastward, and it has continued to do so since. Okay. And every time somebody says that, you know, this is a bad idea, you should not do this, they revert to this ridiculous language of, well, if X, Y, Z country wishes to be part of it, it's its national right to do this. Well, since when did the United States think that it is the national right of Cuba to host, have an alliance with the Soviet Union? I mean, no, the United States would never permit such a thing. But it thinks that Russia should put up with NATO essentially stationing missiles, which are a few minutes away from hitting Moscow. This is ridiculous. So anyway, we have been provoking this. Then we provoked Russia further with the Maidan coup, which the West clearly fomented and supported. Further, the West has been egging Ukraine on with persecuting the internal civil war that began more or less as soon as the coup occurred in 2014, with the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics breaking apart. So the West was essentially encouraging this behavior. And then, even though President Zelensky was elected explicitly By promising, number one, that he would pursue better relations with Russia. Number two, that he would implement the Minsk II Accords. Number three, that he would deal with Ukraine's oligarch problems. On all of these, he did a complete 180-degree turn. He completely reversed on all of that. And all of this was also encouraged by the West. And then the West went through this elaborate charade of asking Russia to say, okay, what are the terms that you want? And Russia did. Russia took the whole process, which began right after the ignominious U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. And as soon as Mrs. Merkel was out of power, this process began. And all the U.S. did was it sort of essentially angered Russia even more, because Russia was engaging in good faith in the dialogue, presenting the terms that it wished to see, even presenting the United States with proposed treaties into which they could enter so there would be no war. It did all of these things. But the West simply continued to encourage Zelensky to step up military action against the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, to talk about acquiring nuclear weapons and whatnot. So in the end, the so-called invasion occurred, the so-called SMO occurred. Essentially, it became a hot war between countries. And it is not a war between Russia and Ukraine. It is a war between NATO and Ukraine. And ultimately, since the United States seems to be calling all the shots in NATO, it is a war between the United States and NATO, in which, as John Mearsheimer points out, the United States wishes to fight Russia till the last Ukrainian. Which then brings me to the question of Ukraine. You know, I do not speak from a position of being anti-Ukrainian. While Mr. Hunka may have done a lot of wrong things, as have a minority of Ukrainians, the vast majority of Ukrainians are sisters and brothers, as all of humanity is. I care about Ukrainians. And what I find so offensive and so mind-bending and Kafkaesque about the situation in which we are living is that all the people who are saying, I stand for Ukraine, I want to aid Ukraine, are actually in the forefront of destroying Ukraine. Because if they had insisted on the implementation of the Minsk Accords, if they had said, okay, in order for us to have a peaceful Ukraine, you need to make good terms with Russia. If they had accepted these things, we would not be here. Ukraine today has already lost territory. It stands possibly to lose more. It is going to emerge from this war a heavily indebted country, not least because all the weapons that we are giving Ukraine are not being given. They are being sold to Ukraine. And Ukraine is going to end up a little rump of a country which is far too indebted to provide anything good for its citizens. None of this would have happened if the West had not provoked Russia using Ukraine. So what the West is doing is, in the name of helping Ukraine, it is using Ukraine. This is the shocking reality of Ukraine. And if you cared about Ukraine, you don't use people and countries you care about. But that's what the West is doing to Ukraine.
And what is the West's aim? What are the United States' objectives? And how do you see this being resolved?
Well, that's a very interesting and good point as well. The United States has been, and first of all, let me add that, you know, the days when you could assume a coherence in U.S. policy are gone. If they ever existed. That is to say that U.S. administrations, U.S. presidents essentially act for, are agents for powerful interests, but there is a plurality of them. And they do not, what they each want does not necessarily cohere into a clear strategy. Okay, so having with that proviso, let me say what the West has to gain from this. So first of all, I would say that in my book, actually, I go into this in some detail. But I would say that obviously one part of the U.S. economy that benefits is a no-brainer. The military industrial complex has been making money hand over fist, not only because all the weapons, which are essentially secondhand hand-me-downs that are being sent to Ukraine will have to be replaced. And already in the last budget that the United States passed, there is a far greater allocation for defense, not least because of not just for replacing the weapons that are lost, but for preparing for wars. And don't forget here that the U.S. is also threatening a similar war against China over Taiwan. In which at one point, it was really quite macabre, but at one point, some U.S. official actually said, maybe it was President Biden, I don't know, but somebody actually said that if there was a war in Taiwan and it looked as if China might gain control of the Taiwan semiconductor, TSMC, whatever, you know, the semiconductor manufacturer, then they would bomb it so that the Chinese wouldn't get their hands on it, at which point I'm sure that all the Taiwanese officials were alarmed. Like, you know, you are our ally and you're talking about bombing our most important asset. I mean, how ridiculous is that? But that shows you. But anyway, the military industrial complex is benefiting a lot from it. And secondly, there has been, you know, the, you know, there is also a divide within the West. So, for example, a few years ago, Andrew Bacevich, the very well-known critic of American foreign policy, was able to get the funding to establish the Institute for Responsible Statecraft, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, which has been very critical of the war over Ukraine, more or less. I mean, I more or less agree with their analysis. And they published a very interesting story in which they pointed out that all the think tanks that are producing the propaganda that is pro pursuing this war against Ukraine are practically all funded by the military industrial complex. Okay. So there's this huge ideological push around it. And the other thing I'll say is that, you know, if you go back to the early 1990s, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the famously anti-Russian American strategist, wrote a book. And in this book, he actually says explicitly that Russia is basically too big, that really it ought to be broken up into a number of smaller parts. And of course, the reason for that is very simple. A very big and resourceful Russia is harder to control than many smaller entities. This process, otherwise known as Balkanization. You know, you Balkanize Russia, you break it up into smaller bits, then they become easier to control. You create little enmities between them, as they are trying to do between, well, they have succeeded in doing between Ukraine and Russia. How wonderful is that, you know? So there is, those are some of the forces that are behind this war over Ukraine. And countries like Canada are going along with it when, in fact, they could have better relations with, you know, I mean, how do you increase your security? You certainly don't do it by making an enemy out of your neighbors. Russia is Canada's neighbor. Europeans are going along with it. You know, every so often when Europe has had some breathing space, they've tried to hammer out a European security strategy, which is independent of the United States and which necessarily involves good relations with Russia. The Europeans were getting close to it just before this Ukrainian operation began. And once again, the United States has upset the apple cart on this front. So the Europeans are essentially now, Germany is really, what's happening in Germany is really spectacular because they are agreeing to the deindustrialization of their country in the interest of this completely unjustified war that is being fought against a country with which just a few years ago, Mrs. Merkel was making all sorts of deals. Quite rightly, I think, as she's getting a lot of flack for it. But anyway, there it is.
Quickly, Radhika Desai, you've been very kind with your time. How do you see the Ukraine-Russia war ending?
That's a very good question. I would say that for a long time, I was hoping for some negotiations. You know, early on, it seemed, particularly in March of 2022, it looked as though in the spring, anyway, somewhere thereabouts of 2022, it looked as though there might be a negotiated agreement with Turkey being a broker. And then we know that Mr. Boris Johnson flew over to Kiev and basically persuaded the Zelensky government not to go along with it. So the war has continued. So one would hope that it ends with negotiation, but it looks as though the West has taken a position where they basically will not negotiate with Russia in any meaningful way. So I would say that it will probably end by Russia winning a military victory on the ground, on the battlefield, which will then actually narrow the choices of Ukraine quite massively. unless something suddenly happened and the West decided to change its position, which is always possible, and I hope it happens, because I certainly don't. I wish this war to have ended a long time ago. I wish this war had never started. But, you know, because war is always difficult, ugly, costly, and tragic. But I see, you know, realistically, I don't see any other possibility than Russia essentially making certain gains that it wishes to make, not exactly taking over all of Ukraine. I don't think that is Russia's intention, ever was Russia's intention. But nevertheless, securing the territories that it has absorbed into Russia at this point, and getting some sort of reasonable assurance that the Nazis that are indubitably part of the current government and the current military of Ukraine are neutralized in whatever way that satisfies Russia. Because I think as long as they exist, they are programmed to be sort of practically congenitally anti-Russian. And this is not going to be a very good thing. So I think that that's what will happen, probably.
Last question, Radhika Desai. What do you read? For those who are news addicts and enjoy reading the news and actually can bear to start reading one more publication, or perhaps, you know, jettison The Guardian and The Globe and Mail and pick up some other publication to read online, what would you recommend?
Well, I have to say, first of all, that I do read the mainstream media, much as I find it problematic. So I read the Financial Times pretty regularly. I do always look at The Guardian. So I always look at the mainstream media. For the rest, I think that we are fortunate that there are a lot of really interesting alternative media outlets. I look at Western alternative media outlets, whether it is Counterpunch or Intercept. But also I follow, we also, by the way, I and several other colleagues publish, have a little blog site or whatever you want to call it, a little website called New Cold War, where we publish all the things from a different sources that we think people should read. I follow a very interesting analyst of military affairs called Alexander Mercouris. Another very interesting writer on world affairs is M.K. Bhadrakumar, who publishes a blog called Indian Punchline. I follow on economic news. I follow a very interesting website called networkideas.org, I think. In the United States, I would follow Black Agenda Report. I think they are very good. I think Sputnik Radio has generally been good, although I see that one of their programs has been shut down. It's called By Any Means Necessary. I used to appear on By Any Means Necessary a fair bit. There is The Critical Hour, which is good. I read The Hindu and Frontline from India. I read RT, and I follow Chinese news media, Global Times, CGTN, for which I write as well a fair bit. So there's a lot, you know, if you are interested, there is an enormous amount of alternative perspectives. There are blogs like yours. So, you know, there is a lot of alternative information that's available. Every time I have a question, I just type it in, you know, into Google. And it's amazing how many alternative media websites come up.
Radhika Desai, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Well, it's a great pleasure, David. And as I said, it's great to be in touch with you again.
Radhika Desai is professor in the Department of Political Studies and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group at the University of Manitoba and convener of the International Manifesto Group. Listen to our whole conversation and follow the blowback at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. over and out for now.
Your support for FunDrive helps our radio station in so many ways. This year, we are replacing our broadcast tower on the top of Burnaby Mountain. This will allow us to make some significant and noticeable improvements to our broadcast signal. Awesomeness doesn't come cheap, and your support helps keep CGSF awesome. Donate today at cgsf.ca/donate.